Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very happy to have the opportunity to speak to you here this evening in these wonderful rooms of the British Academy, and I'm especially grateful for Professor Paul Luff that he has invited me for this lecture. I feel really honored, and I thank Melanie Gibson and Jane Gillespie for all their help in organizing this trip. Travel writing in Persian. First, I will start with a short overview on travel writing and research on this topic. Travel writing in Persian language has a long tradition going back to the 11th century, when Nasir Khosrow wrote his Safarnameh on his 7 years' journey from the far east of the Caliphate to Egypt. Other reports on spectacular voyages were to come, such as accounts of on Timurid and Safavid diplomatic missions to Ming China and Siam. However, a survey by Erich Afshar enumerates only a dozen of Persian travelogues between the 11th and the end of the 18th centuries. These texts are so highly diverse in approach and style that they hardly make up a genre of their own. It is only with the Qajar period, end of 18th century until 1925, that we observe a remarkable increase in Persian travelogues. Bibliographical surveys assess their number with 400 up to 500 texts. But there is still no such thing as a comprehensive and reliable bibliography. Not all of this travel literature was written by Iranians. Central Asian and most notably Indian authors contributed a substantial share. As to Qajar Iran, at least some 280 texts have been identified, the great bulk of them written in the second half of the 19th century during the reigns of Nasiruddin Shah and Muzaffaruddin Shah. This corpus of text comprises accounts of journeys abroad, pilgrimages, and domestic trips. So far, scholarly attention has concentrated rather on Iranians touring Europe and beyond, be it in the context of the first diplomatic missions, students' delegations, official visits of ruling monarchs, or private trips of lesser celebrities. Studies mostly focus on the impression that Europe made on these travelers, on the impact that these cultural encounters had on their worldview, on their perception of their own country, and how they came to terms with their experiences through writing down these in travelogues. Prominent examples are the travel diary of Abul Hasan Khan Ilchi, the first Iranian envoy to the United Kingdom in 1809 and 1819, or the travel memoirs of Mirza Salehi Shirazi, member of the first delegation of Persian students to England, also written about 1820. Nasiruddin Shah's diaries of his first and second trip to Europe in 1873 and 1878, written in a straight and unadorned language, were published in due course, and they certainly contributed to the popularity of travel writing and the social acceptance of using simple prose instead of the traditional verbose idiom of the learned classes. In this paper, I will deal with the more neglected travel accounts written by Iranians who roamed their own country and put their impressions into writing. Again, there can be no talk of a consistent literary genre. The common thread is just that these texts are narratives dealing with factual travels, which in style, concept, and final editorial reworking may differ considerably. Besides true travel diaries, we find accounts which are ingredients of more comprehensive hybrid texts like autobiographies, memoirs, or even geographical surveys. Again, Nasiruddin Shah makes a good point of departure. Just to introduce this gentleman, I found one portrait from his early years, maybe just when he was about 19 and 20 and started to be the ruler. And here a photograph from much later, from the 1880s. His mobility, Nasiruddin Shah's mobility within the country was remarkable. Apart from the traditional seasonal switching from winter to summer quarters and vice versa, and countless hunting trips, he undertook prolonged and in some cases recurrent travels to certain provinces such as Khorasan, Gilan, Mazandaran, or Erak-e-Ajam. As has been observed, the reasons for his extensive traveling were manifold, displaying imperial sovereignty and splendor towards provincial elites and populations, as well as towards court and state officials, concern for territorial integrity, gaining knowledge of regional conditions, demonstrating personal piety in cases of pilgrimage to the shrines of Qom and Mashhad, and certainly some genuine desire for travel may be identified among his motivations. While he was traveling a lot from the very beginning of his reign in 1848, the first travel records from his hand date from 1867, nearly 20 years later. From then on, writing travel diaries became his common practice. For today, I will concentrate on his records regarding Qom. 7 times during his long reign, he went on pilgrimage to the holy shrine of Fatemeh Masumeh, the sister of Ali Reza, the 8th Imam of Twelver Shiism. The accounts of pilgrimages number 4 to 7 are extant, and I will shortly outline number 4 and number 6 to look for shifts in perception and presentation. With his fourth visit to Qom in January-February 1868, when he was 38 years of age, he combined pilgrimage with hunting. The report on this trip is one of his earliest extant travel accounts. It is made up of concise day-to-day entries in simple and unadorned language without contemplation and discussing of political or intellectual matters. He just writes about the recurrent daily routines he observed during this 3 weeks trip, like getting up, going to the hammam, which implies that there was something like a portable bath, I don't know, dressing, traveling on horseback or by carriage, depending on the condition of the road, having lunch and dinner, watching his servants pitching the camp, and so on. He lists the names of officials in his entourage, of the ladies of his harem, as well as of the page boys and attendants who accompanied him. He provides information on evening entertainments, such as cheerful conversation, newspaper reading, or listening to music, spending time in male or female company with Khuruk or Mardane. He regularly remarks which lady had been his maid for the night. We also learn how day-to-day business was done on the road with officials dispatched from Tehran who brought documents to be read and signed and reported the latest news like the decease or demise of a prominent man. In Qom, the Shah made use of the telegraph station, which had been established just a few years before by the Indo-European Telegraph Department for communication with Tehran. On the way, he often mentions who were the landlords of the estates the imperial caravan passed by. He always comments on the weather, and at the end of January and first half of February 1868 were extremely cold and grim, with heavy storms and rainfall, we learn a lot of the strains and stresses the imperial encampment in general, and the Shah in particular, had to endure. The rivers in this winter carried lots of water. To cross those without bridges was another challenge, and some of the pack horses and grooms fell into the water. The distance between Tehran and Qom is 150 kilometers, equivalent to 93 miles. The itinerary reveals that it took the Shah and his Ordu, the royal encampment, 12 days to cover the way there, while the way back was covered in only 4 days. This was because the Shah, on his way to Rome, wanted to roam the area for hunting. So there is ample information on game and fowl, all sorts of animals, and how many of them the Shah and his entourage were able to shoot. The sojourn in the holy city lasted for 5 days. Nasiruddin met local notables and religious scholars, as well as members of the extended Qajar family. The nominal reason of the trip, the pilgrimage to the shrine of Fatemeh Masumeh, is dealt with twice, but rather cursorily. In fact, besides its importance as an outstanding Shiite sanctuary, the holy shrine was also a major dynastic memorial site. It was the burial place of the Shah's father, Muhammad Shah, and his great-grandfather, Fath Ali Shah. These graves had their own pious endowments overseen by a mutawalli. The precious gala weapons and suit of armor of another ancestor, Fath Ali Shah's brother Hussein Quli Khan, were preserved there as an endowment for the hidden imam and duly admired by Nasiruddin Shah. This special dynastic significance of the city of Qom is to be witnessed also in the Shah's later reports. In his recording of the fifth visit in 1871, when he was on his way back from his pilgrimage to the holy shrines in Ottoman Iraq, we find him not only attending the graves of his ancestors, but also deeply moved and mourning at the burials of some more recently demised members of the family and other persons close to him. On occasion of his next visit in 1888, he was by then 58 years old, after seeing, as usual, the ancestors' graves, he again viewed Hussein Quli Qajar's set of gala weapons, which had been arranged and exposed in a new way, like in a kind of museum style. The same report is also remarkable because the Shah put down a detailed record on his sightseeing tours in Qom itself and its vicinity, which highlights the urban development of the city and the interest the Shah took in these developments. The report also reveals how the Shah regarded his visit as an opportunity to show himself to the populace who came in crowds to watch him and all the people accompanying him, his company. Donating alms to the great number of poor people that showed up on this occasion put him in the light of a caring father of his subjects. In the evening, he sat together with his harem on the roof of Amina Sultan's mansion, all enjoyed water pipe and lemonade, and watched the public festivities near the river. On Nasiruddin's order, two balloons were launched to the great amazement of the townsfolk who had never seen such a thing before. It has been commonplace to discount Nasiruddin Shah's travel diaries as trivial and lacking in intellectual depth, and therefore to be of little historical value. But actually, even in their unsophisticated manner, they draw a vivid picture of the itinerant court and in his daily routine and the circumstances of space and time. In the case of Qom, one may discern how observations became more substantial with every visit, and the travel diaries also shed a light on Nasiruddin Shah's perception of his public role. Nasiruddin Shah was not only a producer, but also a passionate reader and above all, commissioner of travelogues. For instance, he used to order officials who were sent away on duty to various regions of Iran to put down final reports on their duty trips, mamuriyat. Some of these texts have been published in recent years, and I will introduce three of them shortly in chronological order of their production. In all cases, the authors belonged to the Shah's personal attendants, Pish Khidmat, and were sent out to deliver a robe of honor or some other gift to provincial governors. The chronologically first of these texts was written by a certain Hassan Ali Afshar from Urumiye, and is entitled Safarnameh Luristan u Arabistan. The editor replaced the letter with Khuzistan. Hassan Ali Afshar was commissioned by the young king to bring robes of honor to the governors of the unruly southwestern provinces of Iran. He set off on 29th of October, 1849, and returned on 10th of March, 1850, So this trip took nearly 4.5 months, covering some 1,500 kilometers, 1,000 miles. 16 days after his return, Hasan Ali submitted his report, some 50 pages, to the Shah. In a marginal note, probably written by Nasir al-Din himself, we read about this author. This book is authored by the servant Hasan Ali Khan, who has been delegated to deliver robes of honor to Luristan and Arabistan, and as ordered, he has written it as a diary. It is not a very sophisticated piece of text. He wrote it just according to his breadth of mind. He made a drawing of this fool, but he is not familiar with taking photos. He knows some English. I know English not very well, but I found that he is able to talk a little. He has a very bad breath. His complexion tends to yellow. He has an extremely big nose. His eyebrows are black and bushy. His eyes big and wide open. He wears military uniform. He shaves his beard, but wears a mustache. His build is neither tall nor short. So we get at least a literal portrait of this man. The somewhat reserved appreciation of the text itself may be due to its linguistic deficiencies. The author came from Urumiye, a Turkish-speaking area, and possibly he had not been professionally trained in writing elegant Persian. There are incomplete sentences and offenses against grammar and orthography. But nevertheless, he wrote a straightforward and concise prose style. As he was a keen observer, his account is abounding in information and worth reading. He never fails to give the distance between two stages and to inform about how much time it took to cover it. He goes into details with geographical and socio-economic features of the regions he traveled through. He comments on landscape, water resources, general climate, current weather conditions, natural flora, crops and fruit, livestock, game and fowl. He carefully describes topography, architecture, and general condition of passed-by villages and cities and makes demographic assessments. His information on nomadic and sedentary groups deals with social affiliation, language, clothing, and food, and in some way gains ethnographic quality. It is true that some of these features also are to be found in classical Arabo-Persian geographical literature, but nevertheless, with its general appeal, Hasan Ali's text reminds more of a modern empirical survey. The reference made in the quoted marginal note that he had some knowledge of English could mean that he had been acquainted with some relevant English geographical literature, something like that. From Tehran, Hasan Ali said it's time for a map. So, where is this? I show his route. I apologize for this not very instructive map. Here's Tehran, and that was his route for Rom, and from Rom to Sultanabad. Modern Iraq, and then to Borujiat, and from there to Khorramabad, as you see it, and finally to Dispo. Okay. From Tehran, Hasan Ali Afshar set off with an escort of 9 mounted attendants. On his way to the Zagros provinces, he had to pass Qom, where he visited the Shrine of Fatima, to pray for the successful outcome of his mission, and also went to see the graves of the Qajar monarchs. So this seems to be an essential for all people connected with the dynasty to see these graves. from Qom, he proceeded to Sultanabad, Iraq, and from there went on to Borujiat, where he was to deliver the first of the robes of honor to the governor of that city, Khonla Mirza. I found a portrait of him, so I didn't want to withhold this from you. The other two were meant for Ardashir Mirza, the nominal governor of Luristan and Arabistan, whose encampment he met near Khorram Shahr, and for the de facto strongman Suleyman Khan, Sahamudole, who was of Armenian origin and resided in Dizful. Also these gentlemen have been portrayed. This would be one portrait of this Ardashir Mirza. And here we see him in the foreground in uniform, and right in the background, this Sahamudole. I'm sorry, I cannot tell you what really is the source. I found this just in Google and so on, with Wikipedia. With dispatching costly robes of honor to provincial governors and to other dignitaries, Qajar rulers followed a long-standing tradition. It was meant to confirm the recipient in his position or reward him for some extraordinary services. The investiture ceremonial, Khilat Pushan, was enacted in public, demonstrating the favor of the Shah and the loyalty of the Doni. It was not for nothing. A return gift to the Shah, Pishkash, and some allowance for the bringer were obligatory. Fat Ali Shah and his successors were renowned for their numerous marriages and progeny. As a result of this dynastic strategy, provincial governorships could regularly be assigned to Qajar princes, as in the case of our text. Khanla Mirza Ehtisham Mudole, the governor of Borujiat, and Ardashir Mirza Ruknudole were both sons of Abbas Mirza Qajar, Nasiruddin's grandfather. Hasan Ali conveys a concise but vivid picture of the Khilat Pushan procedure. When he comes closer to the recipient's place of residence, he dispatches an envoy to announce the arrival of the imperial robe of honor by a formal letter. On his return, the envoy informs on the location where the ceremony is to take place, usually a place outside the city. The recipient shows up with extended retinue for the formal reception, istiqbal. He dismounts, pays homage to the precious garment as representation of royal authority. After the investiture proper, the honored person and his entourage came to the city, where he presented himself again to the public, dressed with the khel'at, and received congratulations. The whole ceremony was staged before the eyes of the populace and was featured by public festivities, including play, music, singing, dances, performances of jesters and wrestlers. Although weather conditions are bad, and it is not good, he was not of good health, he had to hurry to dispatch the second Khilat to Ardashir Mirza to avoid the arrival of the month Muharram, the month when the martyrdom of Hussein and the other Shia imams is mourned. He succeeds to arrive on the very last possible day at Khorramabad and stayed there the following 10 days to partake in the Muharram mourning rituals. At his final destination, Dizful, he had to linger several weeks because the Doni Sahamudole would not let him go for whatever reasons. Although the Khilat Pushan had been the very reason for the trip, it is not the narrative focus of the travelogue. Our author's destinations, Luristan and Arabistan, were regions with sedentary and highly diversified tribal populations. The main groups in the Zagros were of Lur, Bakhtiari, Kurdish, and Turkish affiliations. In the Gulf region, Arab tribes were predominant. All of these split up in many subgroups. There had been considerable tribal upheavals in the region for years, and Borujiat, for instance, had suffered severely from plundering by a Turkish tribal group, and Hasan Ali describes the devastation still to be seen there. And only recently, Luristan and Arabistan had been brought again under control of the central government, due to the action taken by the persons who were now rewarded with a khel'at. Against this sensitive political background, our author's meticulous observations must be understood as a piece of intelligence for the central government. Hasan Ali Afshar is not only interested in the local balances of power between the nominal governors, the Qajar princes, and their managing officials, He also offers insights into the religious hierarchies, as in the case of Borodjed, where he noticed a pronounced factionalism between religious scholars. He does not whitewash grievances as the poverty and misery of the populace of Dysphul and the filthiness of that city, and he does not restrain from giving his opinion or even advice to the Shah, for instance, when he argues how to improve the somewhat desolate condition of Sultanabad or other cities. When he praises the efficiency and accomplishments of the Donis, his tone is respectful but not submissively flattering, and he emphasizes that his judgments are in accordance with public opinion. He discerns between professional merits and personal flaws when he speaks in high terms of Khanla Mirza's beneficial politics, but finds him to be mean when it comes to rewarding his own services as deliverer of the Khel'at. The whole account is mostly object-referred. The author uses third-person forms for himself. Remarks on his personal conditions are mostly related on extraordinary hardships of traveling in winter in a mountainous region. Altogether, Hasan Ali's traveler proves to be a rich source on many topics. The second travelogue was written 6 years later in 1856 by a certain Muhammad Taqi Tajli Shi, whose sister was one of the many wives of Nasiruddin Shah. Thanks to this marriage, Muhammad Taqi had been admitted to the circle of the Shah's personal service, and early in the year of 1856, he had been commissioned to deliver Khel'ats to the governors of Qazvin, Eskandar Mirza Qajar, and to the Wali of Hamadan, Saifullah Mirza, both sons of the late Fat Ali Shah and thus paternal uncles of Nasiruddin. His duty trip was considerably shorter. It took 5 weeks. Muhammad Taqi set off from Tehran on 28th of February, and on 4th of March, he arrived in Qazvin, where he stayed for 5 days. He proceeded to Hamadan, which took him a week, and arrived there 15th of March and stayed for 3 weeks enjoying himself. When the news arrived that Nasiruddin Shah and the Imperial Urdu were approaching Borodjed, he moved on to join them, but this is not part of his travelogue. The day-to-day account informs on past by settlements, on stops and encounters. The ceremonies of Khel'at Pushon are described rather briefly. They conform with what has been said before. There is no comment on why the two governors were honored, for special reasons or just for routinely confirmation in office. Major passages deal with the numerous social contacts the author obviously enjoyed with the local dignitaries in Qazvin and Hamadan. There is a constant exchange of courtesies, ta'arufat, in form of lamps and sweets, of visits and return visits. Lots of coffee and tea are consumed. He is invited to lavish banquets, etc. Even when alone in the evening, he has musicians for his entertainment. There are few scenes which highlight special social milieus and situations. For instance, during his sojourn in Hamadan, he witnesses how the vizier handles complaints of citizens. A woman accuses her son-in-law to have poisoned her daughter with opium. A drunken and rioting youth is given to a baker for education, things like that. When he encounters tribal folk on the road, they are clearly perceived as culturally different. They are depicted as rather poor and not very hospitable. When at a resting place, he comes upon a whole group of them singing and dancing. He observes proprieties, but is obviously relieved to proceed on his way as soon as possible. Altogether, the presumably young author is not as keen an observer of facts as Hasan Ali. He concentrates more on presenting himself as the hero of his own text, which has its modestly adventurous moments. Once he slays a dragon-like snake, and when one night a burglar breaks in his lodging, he takes his saber and runs after him naked. He is so self-centered that he does not mention that he traveled with retinue. This becomes only obvious when he gives some orders to members of this retinue. As to the literary qualities of his text, he mixes plain with more old school ornamented and rhyming prose. Whenever he takes a rest on a pleasant site like a garden or a riverside, he switches to poetic imagery and the site becomes paradise. In the same manner, he relates a rather intimate story right at the beginning of his account. As soon as he had been charged with his mission by the Shah, he prepared for his departure, but suddenly he was approached by a woman who had heard of his prestigious advancement and supposed him to be a good match for her daughter. As the girl's beauty was the talk of the town, he was delighted to accept her proposal, and the marriage was contracted and consumed the same night. His excitement and pleasure are colored in romantic metaphors and verse, and his formal apologize for the delay caused by this marriage is somehow mixed with blatant pride. Nasiruddin has commented on the affair in a marginal note, quote, "Everybody knows that she was not a virgin. There are others who took action before," unquote. Yeah. The third travel diary, put down as an account of a rope of honor mission, was written by a certain Jafar Quli Khan Etemadi more than 30 years after the travelogues number 1 and 2. He also had family ties with Nasiruddin. He was the son of the half-brother of the Shah's mother, Mahde Ulya, and thus Nasiruddin's cousin. But he was born 1864, so the difference in age was 35 years, something like that. He entered the service of the Shah as a page boy, Ghulam Bache, became head of the page boys, Ghulam Bache Bashi, and coming of age, served as personal attendant, Pishirmat. On Nasiruddin's first and second visit to Europe, he was in his retinue. He later was appointed to the important position of Faraj Bashi, literally carpet spreader, who was responsible for outdoor service and also executor of royal punishment commands. He held the honorary title of Hajibodole, and under Muzaffar ad-Din Shah, he was honored with the title Mu'ina Sultan. So he's the only one of these three who made something like a career. The other two were never heard of again. When he was appointed for the Khilat Pushan mission in 1883, he was only 19. The Khilat he had to deliver in this case was not a garment, but a saber embellished with jewels. Maybe Khilats had become unfashionable, I don't know. Zilla Sultan, it was to be received by the oldest surviving son of Nasiruddin Shah, Zilla Sultan, the ambitious and powerful governor of Isfahan, and at that time also of Fars, Western Central Persia, Kurdistan, and Luristan. He was commander of his own well-equipped army, which was probably the most powerful military force of the country. Time for one more picture. I have to come back to this. This is Zilla Sultan here in something which looks like a khalat, but with his uniform underneath. And this is a photo of his Fauche Jalali, his elite corps. Okay. For the way he took the route via Hamadan and Daulatabad, today's Malayer, while for the way back to Tehran he went the more common, convenient, and shorter route via Sultanabad and Qom. Altogether, he covered a distance of 855 kilometers or 535 miles, but the whole travel took him only 15 days. So this is by far the shortest journey of these three. From 26th of September to 9th of October 1883. In contrast to his predecessors in the 1850s, he relied on the government-run postal courier system for transportation. Postal courier stations, chaparkhane, for changing horses, were to be found on all main routes and very often were adjacent to a caravanserai. So here, these were photos. This is one. I cannot identify where it is, but it's such a chaparrone, and here you can see how it looks inside. Yeah. The chapar service provided was not what our author had hoped for. Often he and his company got only horses of minor quality, or there were no horses at all. And so they had to move on with exhausted mounts. One of his companions once got furious when offered a change horse that, according to his words, was not bigger than a goat. More than once, he finds the postal stations in very bad condition and is so disgusted by their filthiness that he prefers to move on. There is much lamentation over the exertions of traveling. Another constant source of frustration is that he could not hunt the deer and fowl that crossed his ways because of the poor physical condition of the postal horses. He comments on the villages he passes by, if they are flourishing and densely populated, what crops they yield, who shares in their property, and what taxes they should yield. As the Shah's envoy, he was regularly invited for a meal by local officials and tribal chiefs. On these occasions, he screened carefully the local conditions. The residences of the provincial officials of Dauladabad, Malayer, and Borochert are depicted as being in a rather bad and rundown state. When he comes to the description of the Khilat Pushan ceremonial, we learn that they were enacted in significant variation of the former examples. When he arrived at the prince's camp, dripping wet from heavy rainfall and totally exhausted, there was no formal istiqbal. The next day, the date for the ceremony was fixed. It was carefully planned as a public event to be staged outside the city of Borochert and the encampment. Before the eyes of the crowds who came to watch the spectacle, Saleh Sultan fell on his knee, demonstrating absolute submissiveness to his father. The investiture was followed not only by the obligatory festivities, but also by a military review. Our author meticulously lists all the different branches of military service, such as the regular regiments of artillery, cavalry, and infantry, Saleh Sultan's Chalali elite corps, and all the tribal brigades from Lorestan that paraded before Saleh Sultan and finally accompanied him back to his encampment, where the daily military exercises with guns and cannons were conducted. Jafar Quli obviously was deeply impressed by the regular spatial arrangement and cleanliness of Saleh Sultan's encampment and the strict discipline that was enforced there. No one was to speak loudly after the tattoo, let alone leave the ordu. It gave a striking contrast to the conditions of the run-down seat of provincial administration with its rusty and broken cannons. His major personal adventure was an excursion with some Bakhtiari chiefs, which was arranged for him by Saleh Sultan, among them the sons of the charismatic head of Bakhtiari Confederacy, Hossein Quli Khan Ilkhani, whom Saleh Sultan had executed 2 years before by order of Nasiruddin Shah, and who were in fact his captives. But he took them with him to this Borochert excursion. So this report falls in a time of strained relations of central government with tribal areas at the southwestern margins of the country. The relationship between Nasiruddin Shah and his son Saleh Sultan also became more and more precarious because of the latter's ambitious policy. He was dismissed, by the way, of all his governorships, save Isfahan, only 5 years later. So his, his staging submissiveness with this falling down to his knees and all these things, it was of no use. Intelligence about what was going on in the order of Saleh Sultan was certainly appreciated by the Shah. The language of this report is very simple and straightforward, almost telegraphic. To sum up, from From the very beginning of his reign, Nasiruddin Shah started traveling Iran extensively, became a prolific writer of domestic travelogues, and ordered others to give written reports of their tours within the country. This highlights his endeavors to spread the authority of the central government to all corners of the country. This authority was threatened by tribal leaders who held sway over major parts of Iran and sometimes also by members of his own family. To explore the tribal areas was a premise to gain the mastery of these territories. The three reports which I have presented to you all were about such sensitive areas in western and southwestern Iran, where tribal upheavals happened regularly. This kind of travelogues, notwithstanding the differences in quality and density of information, therefore may be regarded as a valuable source for regional history and the history of the relationship of central government with the tribal hinterlands of Iran. Sources which up to now have been tapped only rarely. They certainly constitute a welcome complement to evidence from court chronicles, documents, and European travelogues and reports. Thank you for your patience.